Welcome to the Defense and Aerospace Report podcast. I'm your host, Vago Maradian. Our podcast is brought to you by Bell. Since 1935, Bell has been redefining flight. Learn more about its pioneering spirit at bellflight.com. And joining us today is my good friend, Byron Callen of the independent Washington research firm, Capital Alpha Partners. Byron, thanks very much for joining us.
Hey, great to be here, Vago.
Absolute pleasure. And before we get started, our global coverage is sponsored by Leonardo DRS. Northrop Grumman sponsors our weekly cyber report and our cyber coverage overall. Fincantieri Marinette Marine sponsors our naval coverage. General Atomics Aeronautical Systems sponsors our coverage of strategy. And Beretta USA sponsors our land warfare coverage. Bell, Beretta USA, and Leonardo DRS also all sponsored our coverage of AUSA Now, the Association of the United States Army's annual meeting this year, conducted virtually. So Byron, as I mentioned, we're 8 days away from the presidential election, most consequential in generations, as many people regard it. We did talk about this on the Friday roundtable about, you know, that there is a broad bipartisan consensus and that some of the players, even if the Senate flips from Republican to Democratic hands, there's not going to be as dramatic a shift as some people would like to believe. And what's new since last we spoke was the upcoming meeting this week between the chairman of the House Armed Services Committee, Adam Smith, and the chairman of the Senate Armed Services Committee, Jim Inhofe. Walk us through some of your thoughts on this and sort of what's new and what we should be bearing in mind as we go into this electoral season.
Well, look, I think, and actually, you know, probably Congress is going to be the focus this week, at least. I mean, besides the election, I really have nothing new to add to the presidential race. I mean, really, probably at this point, what's the weather going to be on election day around the United States? Although early voting may make that a less relevant measure in many states. But you're right. I mean, Center for New American Security is going to have the HASS chairman, Adam Smith, at an event on the 29th this week that I guess will be webcast or Zoomed or however this thing is going to be done these days. And the fact that the two chairmen of the two authorizing committees are getting together to kind of finalize or start to finalize the 2021 National Defense Authorization Act will be interesting. I don't think anything obviously is going to happen prior to the election. This is part of the process. I think NDAA is kind of on a normal trajectory. If you look at the last 21 NDAAs by fiscal year, 8 of them were concluded in December. I think there were another 4 or so that were done in January. Nothing's going to get done, you know, October's come and gone. And so I think, I think it'll get done. It's just a question of, you know, there's some minor issues. Legato is going to be one. Obviously, the monuments issue is going to be the other. The base naming is going to be the other in the NDA. And that I think will probably get filtered through the outcome of the presidential election.
Let's go to the stocks and how they've been performing, especially in this election year. It's extraordinary, but you have a tendency of looking throughout history in terms of stock performance. So give us a sense on where we are and how some narratives that may be in people's minds may not be as accurate as they might like them.
Well, Bago, I used to do this. You know, you'd go back at presidential election years, look at how a basket of defense stocks perform, create an index. And, you know, lo and behold, you know, they tended to do well in presidential election years. But I think when you start peeling that back and, you know, the counterfactual is this year, large cap U.S. defense has not outperformed the S&P 500. And I think, you know, there are a couple of things that people need to keep in mind here. First, you know, looking back in history, there's a lot more going on than just presidential elections, you know, threat assessments. I think, and the other point that I tried to make was the nature of these companies has changed over time, too. So if you go back and look at, you know, how did they do in the early 70s and in elections in that time frame, you know, you'd have to really consider that Lockheed almost went bankrupt. You know, it had the L-1011 civil airliner program. It's a very different company than it is today. And I'd say the same is true for Raytheon. I mean, Raytheon in 2020 has really being driven probably more by commercial aerospace now than their defense business after the merger with UTC's aerospace businesses. So I'm kind of pushing back against some of the other sell side research that's come out that just kind of blindly says, oh, look at how defense stocks perform in election years or in the year after an election. And I think, you know, people need to just recognize what the past was. And then also, I think the other factor in this election year that makes it somewhat different is, you know, this is the first election in, you know, probably since 1948, where one of the candidates is talking about raising the corporate tax rate. And the U.S. defense sector had been a beneficiary of the tax rate cut that was put into place in 2017. So reversing that is one factor that I think is going to weigh on the sector. And the other is, you know, you could argue in presidential election years, you know, when a new president comes in or when someone's reelected, they kind of want to take their harsh economic medicine in the first year of their new term and then hope that they've got a good runway going either for themselves or their party in their third or fourth year. But this year is different because if you look at consensus GDP expectations, you know, we're having a recession in 2020. Most people, I think, correctly expect that we'll be looking at a better economic outlook in 2021 as the pandemic abates and hopefully as we have a some kind of vaccine program going on. So it's a little different setup for defense, and that can explain to me, you know, why these old hard and fast rules need to be reconsidered.
You know, on that tax rate question, I mean, obviously there's a lot of stuff that will happen between now and then, right? I mean, but first Biden has to win and then Democrats and have to take the Senate and keep the House and, you know, then go through a negotiating process. So sometimes these tax plans don't match exactly, or there are loopholes that are built into it. But from what we know now, as you said, the industry benefited from the Trump Republican tax cuts. Any quantifiable impact on what that tax increase would mean for them now?
Well, yeah. And I think, Vaga, the point to make here is, you know, these companies are largely domestically based. So they were paying, it varies each year. And you'd really have to go back and look many years to kind of get an average effective rate. But this was a sector that didn't have a lot of overseas subsidiaries or, you know, domiciled in countries like Ireland. So they were generally paying something around the effective corporate tax rate. And, you know, you saw some pretty hefty reductions in those tax rates after the 2017 tax cut was put in place. Now, Biden is talking about taking the rate up from 21%, where it currently stands, to 28%. So it's just a fair presumption that in 2022 and beyond, you know, if Congress goes along with that, that these companies are going to see some financial impacts from higher taxes paid, and then there's going to be an impact on their earnings as they start to pay those higher corporate tax rates. So it's just a difference that, as I said, you know, if you look at the history of U.S. corporate tax rates, the last time they were raised was in 1949, or an attempt to do so. They actually went up during the Korean War. And, you know, that's been a steady slide ever since. So it's just something that, you know, when people say, oh, they've always outperformed the presidential election years, it's like, well, yeah, but this is a little different because you're in an environment where you could see a candidate win who's talking about making a change that would have a potentially negative impact on the earnings of these companies.
It's interesting what you say about corporate history, right? I mean, just in the last 25 years, you know, if you look at Raytheon, was a multi-industry conglomerate, became a pure play defense company, and now is a majority commercial aerospace company with its merger with United Technologies, right? So, yeah. You know, you watch this progression of a company that's very different, just like when you go back and you look at Lockheed of the 1970s. I mean, people have a tough time recognizing the incredibly ethical Lockheed Martin of today. Well, the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act was Lockheed Act, right? So people have a tendency of forgetting.
Yeah, the other thing that these analyses completely miss is there's a survivor bias. I've yet to see, you know, I mean, companies like Grumman that were a key defense contractor are no more. You know, that stock,
right.
maybe you can build an index that includes that. I've looked at kind of, you can look at specific election years, but the indices also, I think, are a little misleading because, you know, the people don't own, there's no defense pure ETF. There's an S&P aerospace defense index, but that includes Boeing and the other commercial airplane companies. And institutions are going to own one or two defense stocks if they own them at all. They're not going to own a basket of defense stocks. So I just think, you know, sharpen your pencils a little, take a look at, you know, what's changed and maybe be a little bit more nuanced instead of these sweeping generalizations.
Let me just ask you one thing about Boeing. I mean, we've been talking about that on the weekly business podcast about how the company really is kind of in an existential moment. Obviously, they're going to be, they're looking, or at least news reports suggest that they're looking at a new single aisle commercial jetliner. How does all of this uncertainty on the defense side of their business, the quality problems that they've experienced almost at all of their facilities, right? Tony Capasio of Bloomberg reported that there are problems at Mesa. The Army had suspended buying helicopters, AH-64 Apaches from the company because of quality problems at Mesa a couple of years ago. How does all of this industrial uncertainty with the company that is so important to the ecosystem, what does that mean? And how do folks have to think about it?
Well, I think to your point, Vago, it's, you know, a critical part of, you know, U.S. balance, trade balance. You know, it's an export leader. It's not good. You know, the Boeing's kind of lost its way in the commercial airplane market, at least. And it does have, you know, when you get down to the second, third, fourth tiers of the industry, there are a lot of smaller companies that rely on commercial and military work. And so having, you know, I think DOD partially recognizes this, although, you know, you see the surges in cases in Europe and the United States now, you know, the idea that, you know, we're right around the corner from solving the pandemic. I do worry about, you know, just how quickly things will come back in commercial aerospace, and that will weigh on defense. Obviously, Boeing's done some pretty neat things, though. You know, they do get credit on the T-7 program, you know, for bringing a different approach to that. And so, you know,
that was at a time when they had a lot of investment resources, right?
Well, that's it.
And on the commercial side, when you're hurting, it will have a knock-on effect on the defense.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, so it's going to be interesting. I don't know. I should probably leave it at that.
Let's move on to China. Chinese foreign ministry has made some announcements about American companies. Talk to us about what this means, what the impacts of it are, right? I mean, it's all over Taiwan, effectively. But walk us through what they said and who's included and what does it mean?
What they basically said is a response to the arms sale notifications were announced recently for Taiwan. And this is a package of F-16s, a number of different standoff weapons, HIMARS. I think there's some sea mines that are included in this. That basically they were going to sanction the Boeing Defense Space and Security Unit, Lockheed Martin, and Raytheon. And look, those moves are going to be immaterial to those entities, but I think it's a vector that really has some troubling long-term consequences if this card is continuing to play. And, you know, in a funny way, I think industry is still looking at the global aerospace business as if this is the 1990s when, you know, you can have a pretty healthy defense business and a commercial aerospace business that exports to China and Russia. And arguably, if we are going to be raising more and more barriers, certainly for Chinese companies and their ability to do business in the United States, and at the same time, we're selling weapons to countries that China either considers its own territory or that are also at odds with China, you would expect them to push back. And so China isn't really crossing a red line here with the actions that it announced, but it'll be kind of interesting, you know, in 2021 or 2022, depending on what subsequently happens, you know, how does this start to bear on the commercial aerospace sector? And in particular, if you're a company like Raytheon Technologies, where your part of your whole message is, we're going to use commercial technology to help build our defense business and vice versa, you know, does that model really stand up with access to China, Chinese markets potentially being denied? So I think it's going to be a fascinating trend to watch play out. I'd say the same thing for Boeing, too. I mean, you know, China's still going to be one of the largest, if not the largest market, single country market in the world. And you could see where these things are headed, and it may cause a rethink in some of these multi-sector business models.
EASA, the European Aviation Safety Agency, has cleared the 737 MAX to return to the air, which some folks found surprising in advance of any action by the Federal Aviation Administration. And yet Chinese regulators have made it very clear that they're under, you know, no pressure to move quickly on that. Yeah. Or, you know, that we're going to be deliberative.
Yeah. And I've said this, and I feel strongly that, you know, particularly in an election year, China would be a punching bag, but it's a punching bag that can punch back. And so, you know, when you weaponize things like sanctions and trade, and again, I just think we haven't crossed a red line yet, but I think it's a troubling trend that everybody needs to be aware of. And maybe it should happen. I mean, maybe you really should decouple some of these businesses. But to the earlier point, the discussion on Boeing, you know, if kind of your business model is, okay, we're going to be dual use, dual sector, well, that may have some consequences.
Is it quantifiable what that impact is going to be at this point, or is it too early to say?
I would leave that to your Wall Street panel. You know, okay. I couldn't tell you how big, you know, Boeing's annual sales are to China, or how important Pratt and Whitney and Collins are in China. But again, you know, it is one of the largest aviation markets.
It is, right? And 737 MAX and Airbus sales have been really propelled by China, and the slowdown there, or trade tensions, obviously. And, you know, right, I mean, they're also very, very aggressively working on developing their own aircraft and coming up in that ecosystem. And anybody who bets against China is making a problematic bet, I think, given their success in other industrial sectors, whether trains or reactors or anything else. And let's talk about PAE, because they made an acquisition. Talk to us about the deal and what does it mean?
Sure. So PAE Technology announced this morning that PAE Incorporated announced today that they were buying, or had reached an agreement to buy, Centra Technology, which is a kind of a Boston metro area firm, defense services firm, does a lot with the intelligence community. You know, it's kind of a $200 million plus purchase price. It was interesting. You know, PAE had done a refinancing, well, I guess, last week in anticipation of this deal. So it's just a sign M&A has not been completely dead in 2021. In 2020, you know, you've seen deals done. KBR had announced a kind of defense services business deal earlier. I guess it was in July or so. So, and, you know, the rationale from PAE standpoint is it really gives them more access to adjacent market segments than their current portfolio. It's going to allow them to move up the value chain. It's kind of a similar story we've heard with a lot of services companies, but it's intriguing, you know, that managements are still placing bets despite the uncertainty that might exist around U.S. defense spending in whatever comes out of the election. However, I think, you know, there's also a belief that in some of these areas, particularly in intelligence, it's going to be a relatively safe haven. And so you are seeing companies continue to be active in the M&A space, particularly in the services market.
Let's talk about one last thing you and I have not yet talked about, which is AM General and what happened there. Talk to us about that change in ownership from one private equity group to another, because folks did find that very, very interesting.
Well, I think the interesting part on that deal, yes, you know, there was a change in ownership. The new owner is an owner that's really focused on manufacturing and automotive companies. So AM General's CEO actually spoke during AUSA. I don't know if the the videos are still up on AUASA's website. But, you know, I think the point was you've got an owner who knows kind of the core business of what AM General does, and who is committed to investing in AM General going forward and in some new product areas and enhancing the existing and now venerable Humvee. So I think it's probably a good thing, you know, and I, to the point that AM General made, you know, as much as JLTV is coming and going to replace a portion of the tactical wheeled vehicle fleet in the U.S. and in some international militaries, there's still a very large install base of Humvees globally. I think it's over 200,000 vehicles. So I think their future probably looks pretty good.
Byron, thanks very, very much for joining us. Really appreciate it. Always enjoy the conversation.
Thanks a lot, Vargo.
And now a word from our sponsor, retired United States Army Major General Jeff Schlosser, who is the Executive Vice President for Strategic Pursuits at Bell.
We've been building creative and innovative aircraft, next generation types of capabilities for almost 9 decades. Bell is the company that can deliver that.
Thanks very much, sir. And thanks to all of you for listening. Please follow our daily podcasts and visit the Defense and Aerospace Report website to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. Follow us on Twitter, like us on Facebook at Defense and Aerospace Report, and check us out on LinkedIn. And stay tuned for our weekly cyber report sponsored by Northrop Grumman. Thanks again to Bell for their generous sponsorship, and we'll see you again tomorrow.